to her mother's sense of purpose. The woods were another world, cool and quiet and empty, save for the birds and the squirrels. "I used to come here with your dad." Daisy looked up at her mother with innocent eyes. "Why?" Her mother smiled, remembering. She put down the cool bag and looked up towards the sky. "We're here," she said. The cool bag was at the foot of a huge oak tree, which was bent and twisted like an old man, racked with arthritis. Daisy looked up through its branches, glimpsing flecks and flashes of blue through the flickering canopy of leaves. 20 minutes later, she was sitting in the canopy, looking down at the cool bag. When her mother had announced that they were going to climb the tree, Daisy thought she must be joking. In the absence of a punchline or a laugh, Daisy took refuge in fear. "I can't," she said. "Can't or won't?" Daisy's eyes filled with tears, but her mother was resolute. "You don't know you can't until you try." The silence and the stillness that followed seemed eternal. Eventually her mother spoke. "In this world, Daisy, we are tiny. We can't always win and we can't always be happy. But the one thing that we can always do is try. There will always be trash can Johnsons." A twitch of a smile crossed Daisy's face. "And you can't change that, but you can change how she makes you feel." Daisy wasn't convinced. "How?" "By climbing this tree with me." It was the scariest thing Daisy had ever done. But somewhere before they reached the top, a strange thing happened. Daisy's fear blew away like feathers in the wind. At the bottom of the tree, she was tiny, and the tree an invincible giant. At the top, the tree was still huge, but tiny though she was, she had climbed it. It was the best day of the summer holidays. By the time they walked home across the playing field, the park was nearly empty, and a man riding a mower was about to cut the grass. Her hair had come loose climbing the tree, and she pulled out her hair bobbles and stuffed them into her pocket. But when she got home, she realized one of them was missing. After the triumph of the afternoon, she scarcely cared. When Daisy got ready for bed that night, with her new school uniform hanging on the wardrobe door, she noticed that the face in the mirror was a new face. Happy and excited. Today, Daisy had learned how to conquer a giant. And tomorrow, she was going to big school.
Laura replaced the hair bobble on the shelf and came out of the study, closing the door behind her. Her reflection in the hall mirror was of the face that belonged to the old Laura before Anthony and Padua, hollowed out, defeated. The clock struck 9. She would have to go. She picked up her keys from the small mulling bowl on the hall table where she always left them. But there was one extra. Underneath her bunch of house and car keys was a large single internal door key. Suddenly, Laura understood, and the face in the mirror was transformed by a slow smile. Anthony had left the door to his secret kingdom unlocked for her. His trust in her resurrected the resolve that his death had dissipated. Today, she had been left a kingdom, and tomorrow, she would begin unravelling its secrets.
Chapter 13. Eunice, 1976. Arrogantly sprawled across Eunice's desk, Portia flicked cigarette ash into a pot of paperclips. Eunice had nipped across the road with Douglas to fetch doughnuts from Mrs. Doyle's, and Bomber was seeing a client out. Portia yawned and then sucked greedily on her cigarette. She was tired, bored and hungover. Too many Harvey Wallbangers with Trixie and Miles last night. Or rather this morning. She hadn't got in till 3 a.m. She picked up a manuscript from the pile, which she had carelessly toppled, as she arranged her spiky limbs into a praying mantis posture. "Lost and found," A collection of short stories by Anthony Perdew, she read aloud with sing-song derision. As she flipped over the title page, it ripped free of its treasury tag. Oopsie! She sneered, frisbeeing it across the room. She peered at the first page as though she was sniffing milk to see if it had turned. Good God! What a load of drivel! Who wants to read a story about a large blue button which fell off the coat of a waitress called Marjorie? And to think he wouldn't publish me, his own sister! She threw the manuscript back onto the desk with such violent disdain that it toppled a half-empty cup, soaking the pages with coffee-coloured scorn. "Shag and shit a pig!" Portia cursed as she retrieved the soggy sheaf of papers and hastily hid it halfway down the precarious stack of the slippery slope, just before Bomber bounded back into the room. "Absolutely tipping it down out there now, sis. You'll get soaked. Would you like to borrow an umbrella?" Portia looked up and about, as though trying to locate an irksome blue bottle, and then addressed the room in general. "Firstly, do not call me sis. Secondly, I don't do umbrellas, I do caps. And thirdly, are you trying to get rid of me?" "Yes," called Eunice, bundling back up the stairs, a muddle of Macintosh, damp Douglas, and doughnuts. She dumped Douglas on the floor, the doughnuts on Bomber's desk, and hung up her dripping Macintosh. "I think we might need a bigger boat," she muttered, tipping her head ever so slightly in Portia's direction. Bomber bit back the laugh that threatened to escape. Eunice saw that he was teetering and started dur-dying the music from Jaws. "What is that ridiculous girl going on about now?" Portia squawked from her perch. "Just a cinematic reference to the inclement weather," Eunice replied cheerfully. Portia was unconvinced, but more concerned by the fact that Douglas had wheeled himself as close to her as he could manage, and was about to shake his wet fur in her direction. "Get that blasted rat away from me!" she hissed, retreating, and promptly fell backwards onto Eunice's desk, scattering pens, pots and paperclips in all directions onto the floor. Eunice swept Douglas into the kitchen and soothed his hurt feelings with a doughnut. But Portia's rudeness had finally toppled even Bomber's extraordinary equanimity. His customary geniality slipped from his face like a landslide after a storm. Thunderstruck, he grabbed Portia by the wrists and heaved her from Eunice's desk. "Clear it up," he commanded, gesturing at the mess she had made. "Don't be silly, darling," she replied, picking up her bag and searching inside it for her lipstick in an attempt to disguise her surprise and embarrassment. "I have people to do that sort of thing." "Well, they're not here now, are they?" fumed Bomber. "No, darling, but you are," said his sister, applying a fresh slick of scarlet. "Be a sweetie and call me a cab." Red-faced, she dropped her lipstick back inside her bag and clip-clopped downstairs in her ridiculous heels to wait for the car she knew her brother would order. Portia hated it when he was cross with her, but she knew that she deserved it, and the fact that he was right made her worse. She was like a toddler stuck in an eternal tantrum. She knew that she behaved badly, but somehow couldn't seem to stop herself. She sometimes wished that they could go back to when they were children, and he was the big brother who doted on her. As Bomber watched her go, he tried and failed to recognise in this brittle woman even the faintest trace of the affectionate little girl that he had once loved so dearly. For years now he had mourned the sister he had lost so long ago, who had hung on his every word, ridden on the crossbar of his bicycle, and carried his maggots when he went fishing. In return, he had eaten her sprouts, taught her to whistle, and pushed her as high as the sky on her swing. But she belonged to the distant past, and his present was poisonous, Portia. He heard the cab door slam, and she too was gone. "Is it safe to come in?" Eunice poked her head around the kitchen door. Bomber looked up and smiled apologetically. "I'm so sorry about this," he said, gesturing at the floor around her desk. Eunice grinned. "Not your fault, boss. Anyway, no harm done." They gathered the things up from the floor and restored them to their proper places. "Ah, I spoke too soon," said Eunice, cradling a small object in her hand. It was a picture of a lady holding flowers, and the glass inside the gold-coloured frame was smashed. She had found it on the way home from her interview and had kept it on her desk from her first day. It was her lucky charm. Bomber surveyed the damage. "I'll soon have that fixed," he said, taking the picture from her and placing it carefully in an envelope. He disappeared downstairs without another word. Eunice finished rescuing her things from the floor and swept up the cigarette ash. Just as the kettle boiled, Bomber returned, both in body and spirit, soaking wet again, but his broad smile and good humour restored. "The watchmaker on Great Russell Street has assured me that the glass will be replaced by tomorrow afternoon at the latest." They sat down to their very belated tea and doughnuts, and Douglas, finally assured of Portia's departure, wheeled himself back into the room, hoping for seconds.
"She wasn't always like this, you know," said Bomber thoughtfully, stirring his tea. "I know it's hard to believe, but as a little girl she was really quite sweet, and, for a little sister, tremendous fun."
"Really?" Eunice was understandably sceptical. "What happened?"
"Great Aunt Gertrude's trust fund."
Elevated eyebrows registered Eunice's curiosity.
"She was my mother's aunt, rich, pampered, and cantankerous as hell. She never married, but always longed for a daughter. Unfortunately, Ma wasn't her idea of a girl at all. Couldn't be bought with expensive dolls and pretty dresses. Might have had more luck with a pony or a train set, but anyway."
Bomber bit into his doughnut and squirted jam onto his chin.
"Portia was a different matter. Ma tried to intervene, withheld some of the more lavish gifts, remonstrated with the termagant Gertrude face to gargoyle face. But as Portia grew up, Ma's influence inevitably diminished. Furious at what she called Ma's jealous meddling, when the great Gertie died, she took her revenge. She left a lot to Portia. And it was a lot. Of course, Portia couldn't touch it until she was 21, but it didn't matter. She knew it was there. She stopped bothering to make a life for herself and started waiting for one to happen to her. You see, great Gertie's legacy was a tainted tiara, the worst gift of all. It made Portia rich, but robbed her of any sense of purpose."
"Thank goodness I'm not filthy rich, if that's what it does to a girl," Eunice joked. "Just how filthy exactly?"
"Feculent."
Eunice cleared away the tea things and went back to work. Bomber was clearly still fretting over the effect of Portia's tantrum.
"I hope you're not sorry that you came to work here."
Eunice grinned manically.
"I must be nuts to be in a loony bin like this office," she said in her best Jack Nicholson voice.
Bomber laughed his relief as he picked up a loose sheet of paper from the floor by his desk and screwed it into a ball.
Eunice leapt to her feet, arms in the air. "Hit me, Bomber. I got the moves."
They had been to see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest that week for the third time. They spent so much time together now, both in and out of work, that Bomber couldn't imagine life without her. The film had made an indelible mark, and the ending had had them both in tears. Eunice knew the script almost by heart.
"So, you're not about to hand in your notice and leave me to the mercy of my sister?"
Bomber's eyes almost filled with tears again, as she replied with a line from the end of the film.
"I'm not going without you, Bomber. I wouldn't leave you this way. You're coming with me."
And then she winked. "Now, about my pay rise."
Chapter 14. The girl watched as the tiny scarlet dome on black legs crawled across the back of her hand towards the curl of her little finger. "Ladybird, ladybird, fly away home. Your house is on fire. Your children have gone. All except one, and she is called Anne. And sorry, but she died." The ladybird opened her wings. "It's not truth." The girl spoke slowly, as though she were reciting a poem that she was struggling to remember. "It's only a made-up sing-song." The ladybird flew off anyway. It was hot, September. The girl sat swinging her legs on the wooden bench that faced Padua from the small green. She had watched as the shiny black cars had arrived outside the house. The first one had big windows in the side, and she could see a box for dead people inside, with flowers growing out of its lid. A sad lady and an old man, but not the man who lived there, came out of the house. The girl didn't know who the old man was, but she had seen the lady lots of times before she was sad. The man in the black chimney-pot hat put them in the second car. Then he went to the front of the car with the box in and started walking. He had a stick, but not a limp. But he was walking slowly, so perhaps he had a bad leg after all. She wondered who was in the box. Thinking was something she did slowly. She was quicker at feeling. She could feel happy or sad or angry or excited in a wrinkling of the eye. And she could feel other things too, which were more difficult to explain. But thinking took longer. Thoughts had to be put in the right order in your head and looked at properly so that your brain could do the thinking. Eventually, she decided that it must be the man who lived in the house who was in the box. And she was sad. He had always been nice to her, and not everyone was. After a long time, she had a nice watch, but she hadn't quite worked out the time, please, Mr. Wolf, yet. The sad lady came back on her own. The girl scratched the back of her hand where the ladybird's feet had tickled. Now that the man was dead, the lady would need a new friend. Laura closed the front door behind her and slipped out of her black court shoes. The cold tiles of the hall floor kissed her aching feet, and once again the peace of the house enveloped her. She padded through to the kitchen and poured herself a glass of wine from the fridge. Her fridge. Her kitchen. Her house. She still couldn't quite believe it. The day after Anthony had died, she had telephoned his solicitor, hoping he would know if there was anyone she should contact, a distant cousin that she didn't know about, or a designated next of kin. He sounded as though he had been expecting her call. He told her that Anthony had instructed him to inform Laura immediately after his death that she was his sole heir. Everything he had owned was now hers. There was a will and a letter for her, the details of which would be revealed after the funeral. But Anthony's first concern had been that she shouldn't worry. Padua would remain her home. His kindness made his death all the more unbearable. She had been unable to continue the telephone conversation, her words choked by tears. It was no longer grief alone that overwhelmed her, but relief for herself, chased by guilt that she could feel such a thing at such a time. She took her wine through to the study and sat down at the table. She felt a strange solace surrounded by Anthony's treasures. She was now their guardian, and they gave her a sense of purpose, even though she was as yet unsure as to what that might be. Perhaps Anthony's letter would explain, and then she might find a way to deserve his extraordinary generosity towards her. The funeral had been a revelation. Laura had expected there to be only a handful of people, including herself and Anthony's solicitor, but the church was almost full. There were people from the publishing world who had known Anthony as a writer, and others who had only known him to say good morning to, but it seemed as though he touched the lives of everyone he met and left an indelible mark. And then, of course, there were the busybodies, stalwart members of the local residents' association, WI Amateur Dramatic Society, and general purveyors of the moral high ground, led by Marjorie Wadscallop and her faithful deputy, Winnie Cripp. Their heartfelt condolences, offered a little too enthusiastically as Laura left the church, had been accompanied by sad, well-practiced smiles and unwelcome hugs that left Laura smelling of damp dog and hairspray. The large blue button that Laura had taken from the drawer on her first visit to the study was still on the table, resting on its label.
Large blue button from woman's coat, found on the pavement of Greydown Street, the 11th of November. Margaret was wearing her dangerous new knickers. Ruby silk with sumptuous cream lace was how the saleswoman had described them, clearly wondering what business Margaret had buying them. They were not even distant cousins of her usual Marks and Spencer utility wear. Downstairs, her husband waited expectantly. 26 years they had been married, and he had done his best to let Margaret know how much he loved her for every one of those years. He loved her with his fists and his feet. His love was the colour of bruises, the sound of breaking bones, the taste of blood. Of course, no one else knew. No one at the bank where he was assistant manager, no one at the golf club where he was treasurer, and certainly no one at the church, where in the first year of their marriage he had been born again a Baptist bedlamite. Beating the crap out of her was God's will, apparently. But no one else knew. Just him, God, and Margaret. His respectability was like a neatly pressed suit, a uniform he wore to fool the outside world. But at home, in Mufti, the monster reappeared. They'd never had any children. It was probably for the best. He might have loved them, too. So why had she stayed? Love, at first. She had truly loved him. Then fear, weakness, desolation. All of the above. Body and spirit crushed by God and Gordon. "Where the fuck's my dinner?" a voice bawled from the sitting room. She could picture him, fleshy-faced and florid, rolls of fat seeping over the belt of his trousers, watching the rugby on the television and drinking his tea. Tea that Margaret had made. Milk and 2 sugars. And 6 tramadol. Not enough to kill him, not quite. God knows she had enough. The last time she tripped and broke her wrist, that kind doctor in A&E had given her a whole box. Not that she wasn't tempted. Manslaughter with diminished responsibility thrown in seemed like a fair trade. But Margaret wanted him to know. Her left eye was almost swollen shut and the colour of the Valpolicella Gordon was expecting to swill with his dinner. Touching it, she winced, but then she felt the whisper of soft silk brushing against her skin and smiled. Downstairs, Gordon wasn't feeling quite himself. When she entered the sitting room, she looked him straight in the eyes for the first time in years. "I'm leaving you." She waited to make sure that he understood. The rage in his eyes was all the confirmation she needed. "Get back here, you stupid bitch!" He tried to haul himself from his chair, but Margaret had already left the room. She heard him crash to the floor. She picked up the suitcase in the hall, closed the door behind her, and walked down the drive without looking back. She didn't know where she was going, and she didn't care as long as it was away. The bitter November wind stung her bruised face. Margaret put down her suitcase for a moment to fasten the top button of her old blue coat. The worn-out thread snapped, and the button spun through her fingers and onto the pavement. Margaret picked up her suitcase and left the button where it was. "Sod it," she thought. "I'll buy a new coat. Happy birthday, Margaret."
Laura awoke to the sound of knocking. She had fallen asleep, slumped over the table, and her cheek now bore the imprint of the blue button it had been resting on. Still befuddled with sleep, she slowly realised that the knocking was coming from the front door. In the hall, she passed her suitcase, still waiting to be unpacked. She had decided that tonight would be the first night that she would stay at Padua. It had somehow felt right to wait until after the funeral. The knocking began again, insistent but not urgent. Patient. As though the person would wait for as long as it took for someone to answer. Laura opened the door to a young girl with a serious and beautiful moon face, set with almond-shaped eyes the colour of conkers. She had seen her many times before, sitting on the bench across the green, but never this close. The girl drew herself up to her full height of 5 feet and 1 1/4 inches, and then she spoke.
"My name is Sunshine, and I can be your new friend."
Chapter 15.
"When the sitter comes, shall I make the lovely cup of tea?"
Laura smiled. "Do you know how?"
"No."
It had been 2 weeks since Anthony's funeral, and Sunshine had called every day apart from on Sundays when her mum had stopped her.
"Give the poor woman a day off, Sunshine. I'm sure she doesn't want you pestering her peace and quiet all the time."
Sunshine was unfazed.
"I'm not a pester. I'm her new friend."
"Whether she likes it or not," her mum muttered as she peeled the potatoes ready for Sunday lunch. Her mum worked long hours as a carer for the elderly, and she was rarely at home during the day, and her dad worked on the trains. Sunshine's older brother was supposed to keep an eye on her, but he rarely noticed anything that didn't take place in high definition on a screen the size of a kitchen table that obscured most of his bedroom wall. Besides, she was 19. They couldn't keep her locked up like a child. To be honest, she was pleased that Sunshine had found something else to do other than sit on a bench all day. But she was always anxious about the response of strangers to her daughter's sudden and enthusiastic attachments. Sunshine was fearless and trusting, but her courage and good nature made her vulnerable. Her virtues were often her most serious handicap. Her mum had popped round to see the woman, Laura she was called, who owned the big house, to check whether or not she minded Sunshine's visits. She also wanted to satisfy herself that Sunshine wouldn't come to any harm. The woman seemed nice enough, if a little standoffish, and said that Sunshine was very welcome. But it was the house itself that reassured her the most. It was very beautiful, but more than that, it had a lovely feeling about it that she struggled to describe to her husband, Bert. "It just feels safe," was the best she could do to explain why she was happy to approve her daughter visiting Padua. For Sunshine, it was the highlight of her day, and now she sat at the kitchen table waiting patiently for Laura's answer. Laura paused, kettle in hand, and looked into Sunshine's serious face.
"I suppose I could show you how."
Some days she found Sunshine an unwelcome intruder into her new and as yet uncertain life. A determined gatecrasher. Of course she would never have admitted it. She had even told Sunshine's mum that she was very welcome. But some days Laura pretended not to be in, leaving Sunshine on the doorstep, patiently but persistently ringing the bell. Once she had even hidden in the garden, behind the shed. But Sunshine had eventually found her, and her beaming smile of delight had made Laura feel like a prize-winning idiot and a cold-hearted bitch. Anthony's solicitor was coming today with the will and the letter. Laura had explained this to Sunshine, but could never be sure exactly how much she understood. She was watching Laura intently now as she set the kettle on the hob and took a fresh traycloth from the drawer. Mr. Quinlan was due at 2:30 p.m. Before that, Sunshine managed to squeeze in 5 practice runs, including the washing up, and Laura, as Mr. Quinlan's stand-in, had been forced to tip the last 3 cups into the aspidistra for the sake of her bladder. Mr. Quinlan arrived on time. Sunshine recognised him as the old man who had come out of the house with Laura on the day of Anthony's funeral. He was wearing a charcoal grey pinstripe suit, and a pale pink shirt, and a gold watch chain could just be seen disappearing into his waistcoat pocket. He looked important. Uncertain how to greet a person of such standing, Sunshine bobbed a little curtsy and offered him a high five.
"I'm delighted to meet you, young lady. I'm Robert Quinlan.
And who are you?"
"I'm Sunshine, the new friend for Laura. People sometimes call me Sunny for short."
He smiled.
"Which do you prefer?"
"Sunshine."
"Do people ever call you Robber?"
"It's an occupational hazard, I'm afraid."
Laura led them through to the garden room, and Sunshine made sure that the sitter had the best chair. She looked at Laura meaningfully.
"Shall I go and make the lovely cup of tea now?"
"That would be very helpful," Laura replied, secretly wishing that she had nipped to the loo just one more time before Mr. Quinlan had arrived. Mr. Quinlan read the contents of the will to Laura while Sunshine was in the kitchen. It was clear and simple. Anthony thanked Laura for her work and friendship, but most particularly for her loving care of the house and everything in it. He wanted Laura to inherit all that he owned on the condition that she lived in the house and kept the rose garden exactly as it was. He knew that Laura loved the house almost as much as he had, and he had died content in the knowledge that she would continue to care for it and
take the best possible advantage of all the happiness and peace it had to offer. "And so, my dear, it's all yours. As well as the house and its contents, there's also a sizable sum in the bank, and any royalties from his writing will now come to you."
Mr. Quinlan peered at her over the top of his horn-rimmed spectacles and smiled.
"Here's the lovely cup of tea."
Sunshine barged the door open with her elbow and inched her way into the room like a tightrope walker. Her knuckles were white from the weight of the tray she was carrying, and the tip of her tongue poked out of her tiny rosebud mouth in agonized concentration. Mr. Quinlan leapt to his feet and relieved her of her burden. He set the tray down on a side table.
"Shall I be mother?" he asked.
Sunshine shook her head.
"I've got a mum. She's at the work." "Quite right, young lady. I meant, shall I pour the tea?"
Sunshine considered carefully for a moment.
"Do you know how?"
He smiled.
"Perhaps you'd better show me."
3 expertly poured cups of tea and 2 custard creams later, all consumed under Sunshine's unswerving observation, Mr. Quinlan's visit was drawing to a close.
"Ah, just one more thing," he said to Laura. "The 3rd condition of the will."
He handed Laura a sealed white envelope bearing her name in Anthony's handwriting.
"I believe this explains it in greater detail, but it was Anthony's wish that you should endeavour to return as many of the things in his study to their rightful owners as you possibly can."
Laura recalled the groaning shelves and packed drawers and balked at the enormity of the task. But how?
"I can't begin to imagine. But Anthony clearly had faith in you. So perhaps all you need is a little faith in yourself. I'm sure you'll find a way."
Laura was less sure than hopeful, but then hope went well with faith, didn't it?
"She had wonderful red hair, you know."
Mr. Quinlan had picked up the photograph of DeRay's. "Did you ever meet her?" Laura asked. He traced the outline of the face in the photograph wistfully with his finger.
"Several times. She was a magnificent woman. Oh, she had a wild streak and a fiery temper when roused. Still, I think every man who met her fell just a little bit under her spell."
Clearly reluctant to let her go, he put the photograph back on the table.
"But Anthony was the only chap for her. He was my friend as well as a client for many years, and I never saw a man more in love. When she died, it crushed his soul. It was the saddest thing."
Sunshine sat quietly, listening to every word and gathering them all in so that she could try to sort them into the proper story later.
"Let me guess,"
said Mr. Quinlan, getting up and going over to the gramophone.
"The very thought of you, Al Bowley."
Laura smiled. It was their song.
Of course. Anthony told me the story.
I'd love to hear it. Since Anthony's death, Laura had been increasingly saddened by the realization that she knew so little about him, and in particular about his past. Their relationship had been firmly fixed in the present, forged by daily routines and events, and not by sharing the past or planning for the future. So now Laura was keen to find out anything she could. She wanted to better know the man who had trusted her and treated her with such kindness and generosity. Mr. Quinlan returned to his seat in the best chair.
One of Anthony's earliest and most precious memories was when he was a little boy dancing to that tune. It was during the Second World War, and his father was home on leave. He was an officer in the RAF. That evening his parents were going to a dance. It was a special occasion, and his father's last night, so his mother had borrowed a beautiful lilac evening gown from a friend. It was a Schiaparelli, I believe. There was a photograph Anthony had. Anyway, they were having cocktails together in the drawing room when Anthony came in to say good night. They were dancing to that Al Bowley song, his dashing father and elegant mother, and they gathered him up into their arms and danced with him between them. He said he could still remember the smell of his mother's perfume and the surge of his father's uniform. It was the last time they were together, and the last time he saw his father. He returned to his airbase early the next morning before Anthony was awake. 3 months later, he was captured behind enemy lines and was killed, attempting to escape from Stahlgluft 3. Many years later, not long after they met, Anthony and Therese were having lunch in a wine bar in Covent Garden that favoured Deco over Donny Osmond and David Cassidy. The pair of them always did seem to belong to another age. The Al Bowley song started playing, and Anthony told Therese the story. She took his hand and stood up and danced with him then and there, as though they were the only ones in the room.
Laura was starting to understand. She sounds like an amazing woman. Mr. Quinlan's reply was heartfelt.
Indeed she was.
As he began packing his paperwork into his briefcase, the silent sunshine stirred.
Would you like the lovely cup of tea again?
He smiled gratefully but shook his head.
I'm afraid I must go, or else I shall miss my train.
But in the hall he paused and turned to Laura.
I wonder if I might use the loo before I go.
Chapter 16. The paper knife was solid silver, with a handle in the form of an Egyptian pharaoh. Laura slid the blade between the folds of thick white paper. As the envelope split open, she imagined Anthony's secrets escaping like a cloud of whispers into the air. She had waited until Sunshine had gone home before bringing the letter into the study. The garden room was more comfortable, but it felt more fitting to read it surrounded by the things it concerned. The mild summer evenings had slipstreamed imperceptibly into crisp autumn twilights, and Laura was half tempted to light the fire in the grate. But instead she pulled the sleeves of her cardigan down to cover her knuckles and slid the letter out of the envelope. She unfolded the stiff sheets of paper and spread them on the table in front of her.
My dear Laura.
Anthony's deep and gentle voice sounded in her ears, and the black writing disappeared into a blur, washed away by the tears which filled Laura's eyes. She sniffed loudly and wiped her eyes on her sleeve.
For God's sake, Laura, get a bloody grip, she admonished herself,
and was surprised by the smile that hijacked her lips.
My dear Laura, by now you will know that Padua and everything in it is yours. I hope that you will be very happy living here, and will forgive my foolish sentimentality about the rose garden. You see, I planted it for Thérèse, who was named after St. Thérèse of the Roses. When she died, I scattered her ashes amongst the roses so that I could always be near to her. And if you could possibly bring yourself to do it, I should like mine to be scattered there too. If you find it too gruesome, perhaps you can ask Freddy to do it. I'm sure he wouldn't mind. He has the constitution of a concrete cockroach, dear boy. And now I must tell you about the things in the study. Once again, it starts with the rose garden. On the day I planted it, Thérèse gave me a gift. It was her first Holy Communion medal. She told me that it was to say thank you for the rose garden, and to remind me that she would love me forever, no matter what. She made me promise to keep it with me always. It was the most precious thing that I have ever owned, and I lost it. On the day that Thérèse died, I had it in my pocket that morning when I left Padua, but by the time I returned it was gone. It felt as though the last remaining thread that bound us together had been broken. Like a clock unwound, I stopped. I stopped living and began existing. I breathed, ate, drank, and slept, but only as much as I had to, and that was all. It was Robert who eventually brought me to my senses. "What would Thérèse think?" he said. And he was right. She had been so full of life, and it had been stolen from her. I still had life, but was choosing a living death. She would have been furious. "And heartbroken," said Robert. I began walking, visiting the world again. One day I found a glove. Ladies, navy blue leather, right hand. I took it home and labelled it, what it was and when and where I'd found it. And so it began, my collection of lost things. Perhaps I thought that if I rescued every lost thing I found, someone would rescue the one thing left in the world that I really cared about, and one day I might get it back and so restore my broken promise. It never happened, but I never gave up hope, never stopped gathering in the things that other people had lost. And those tiny scraps of other people's lives gave me inspiration for my stories and helped me to write again. I know it is likely that most of the things are worthless, and no one will want them back. But if you can make just one person happy, mend one broken heart by restoring to them what they have lost, then it will have all been worthwhile. You may wonder why I kept all this secret, kept the study door locked for all those years. I hardly know myself, except perhaps it was that I was afraid of being thought foolish or even a little insane. And so this is the task I leave you with, Laura. All I ask is that you try. I hope that your new life is everything that you wish for, and that you find others to share it with. Remember, Laura, there is a world outside of Padua, and it is well worth a visit now and then. One final thing. There is a girl who often sits on the bench across the green from the house. She seems to be something of a lost soul. I have often wished that I could do more for her than a few kindly words, but unfortunately it is difficult for an old man to help a young lady nowadays without being sadly misconstrued. Perhaps you could gather her in and offer a little friendship. Do what you think is best. With fondest love and grateful thanks, God bless. Anthony.
By the time Laura stirred from her chair in the study, her limbs were stiffened by cold. Outside, in a black sky, hung a perfect pearlescent moon. Laura sought warmth in the kitchen and set the kettle to boil as she pondered Anthony's requests. The scattering of his ashes she would do gladly. Returning the lost things was not so simple. Once again, she felt those stones in her pocket, reminding her of who she really was. Laura's parents had been dead for some years now, but she had never been able to shake the feeling that she had let them down. They had never said as much, but in all honesty, what had she ever done to repay their unfailing love and loyalty and make them proud? She had dodged university, her marriage had been a disaster, and she had failed to give them a single grandchild.
and she had been eating fish and chips in Cornwall when her mother died. The fact that it had been her first holiday since she had left Vince wasn't any kind of excuse. When her father had died just 6 months later, Anthony filled some of the void that had remained. And perhaps now the task that he had left her would be her chance to make some sort of amends. Perhaps this was her opportunity to finally succeed at something. And then there was Sunshine. In this, at least, she was ahead of Anthony. But she couldn't take any credit for it. It was Sunshine who had offered her friendship first, and even then Laura had been, was still, reluctant to reciprocate. She thought about all the times that she had seen Sunshine before Anthony had died and done nothing, said nothing, not even hello. But Anthony had done what little he could, even after his death. Laura was disappointed in herself, but she was determined to try and change. She took her tea upstairs to the rose-scented bedroom she had claimed for her own, or rather that she had chosen to share with Therese, because she was still there. Her things were still there. Not her clothes, of course, but her dressing table set, the photograph of her with Anthony, which was inexplicably face down once more, and the little blue enamel clock, 11:55, stopped again. Laura put down her cup and wound the clock until its gentle ticking resumed. She went to bed, leaving the curtains wide open, and outside the perfect moon veiled the rose garden in a ghostly damask of light and shade.
Chapter 17. Eunice, 1984. At Christmas time we da-dee-da and we vanish shade. Mrs. Doyle was in fine voice as she served the man in front of Eunice with two sausage plats and a couple of squares of Tottenham cake. She paused for breath to greet Eunice. "He's a great bloke, that Bob Gelding, getting all those pop singers to make a record for those poor blighters in the rest of the words slipped away from Mrs. Doyle's lexical grasp. "In the desert." Eunice smiled in agreement. "He's almost a saint." Mrs. Doyle began putting doughnuts in a bag. "Mind you," she continued, "it's not as though that boy George and Midget Ewer and the like can't afford to do a bit of charity. And those bananas, lovely girls, but not a hairbrush between them by the looks of things." Douglas was undisturbed by Eunice's returning footsteps up the stairs. His grey and grizzled muzzle twitched, and his front paws flicked gently as he dreamed of who knows what. But it must have been a happy dream, Eunice thought, because the corners of his mouth were turned up in a smile. Bomber was watching him from his desk, like an anxious child from a window watching his snowman begin inevitably to melt. She wanted to reassure him, but there was nothing she could say. Douglas was getting old. His days were growing shorter in length and in number. He would die, and hearts would break. But for now he was warm and content, and when he eventually woke, a cream doughnut would be waiting for him. The switch from jam to cream, which was actually jam and cream, was an effort to keep Douglas's old bones padded with a little of the flesh that seemed to mysteriously dissolve with each passing year. Bomber, however, was experiencing the exact opposite. In the 10 years or so that Eunice had known him, he had eventually managed to grow a very modest tummy to add a little softness to his still rangy frame. He patted it affectionately as he said for the umpteenth time, "We must stop eating so many doughnuts," a comment completely unaccompanied by any sincerity or intent, and duly ignored by Eunice. "Are your parents coming into town this week?" Eunice had grown very fond of Grace and Godfrey, and looked forward to their visits, which were unfortunately becoming less and less frequent. It was all too apparent that old age was an unforgiving wingman. Godfrey, in particular, was becoming less solid in both body and mind, his reason and robustness inexorably stealing away. "No, not this week. They're feeling a bit out of sorts. Stoked up the Arga, stocked up on the single malt, and secured the portcullis, I shouldn't wonder." Bomber was frowning at a manuscript that was open on his desk. "Why? What's up?" Eunice was concerned. Well, one of their good chums was caught up in that bomb in Brighton. And then there was the fire in the tube station a couple of weeks ago, and that's on their normal route. I just think that they feel, in the words of that classic song, favoured by teddy bears, it's safer to stay at home. Alma slapped the manuscript shut. Probably just as well. I think that Ma might have felt duty-bound to inquire about this. He waggled the manuscript at Eunice as though it were a rotting fish. Douglas finally stirred in his corner. He took in his surroundings through aged, opalescent eyes, and finding them safe and familiar, summoned the energy to gently wag the tip of his tail. Eunice rushed over to kiss his sleep-warm head and tempt him with his doughnut, which was already cut and plated to his exacting requirements. But she hadn't forgotten the rotting fish. "What is it?" Bomber heaved an exaggerated sigh.
"Oh, it's called Big Head and Bigot."
"Sounds intriguing."
"Well, that's one word for my darling sister's latest livre terrible. It's about the five daughters of a bankrupt football manager. Their mother is determined to marry them off to pop stars or footballers or anyone who's rich. She parades them at the local Hunt Ball, where the eldest, Janet, is asked to dance by the special guest, a young, handsome owner of a country house hotel, called Mr. Bingo. Her sister Izzy is rather taken with his enigmatic friend, Mr. Arcee, a world-famous concert pianist, but he thinks that the antics of the young farmers in attendance are rather vulgar, and refuses to join Izzy in a karaoke duet. She calls him a snob and goes off in a bit of a huff. To cut a long and strangely familiar story short, the youngest daughter runs off to Margate with a second-rate footballer where they get matching tattoos. She falls pregnant, is dumped, and ends up in a bedsit in Peckham. After some well-intentioned but rather pompous interference from Mr. Arcee, Janet eventually marries Mr. Bingo, and after his agent forbids it, Mr. Arcee ends up making sweet music with Izzy. Eunice had given up trying to keep a straight face by now and was howling with laughter at Portia's latest literary larceny. Bomber continued regardless. The girl's cousin, Mr. Coffins, a religious education teacher at an extremely expensive and completely incompetent private girls' school, offers to marry any of the sisters who will have him, but to their mother's despair, none of them will on account of his bad breath and protruding belly button, and so he marries their other cousin, Charmaine, on the rebound. Charmaine is happy to have him, as she has a slight moustache and is on the shelf at 21½. Poor Charmaine! If she has to settle for bad breath and a protruding belly button at 21½, what hope is there for me at almost 31? Bomber grinned. Oh, I'm sure we could find you a nice Mr. Coffins of your own, if you really want one.
Eunice threw a paperclip at him. Later that evening, she wandered round the garden of Bomber's rambling flat while he cooked their supper, closely supervised by Douglas. She would never marry. She knew that now. She could never marry Bomber, and she didn't want anybody else. So that was an end to it. In the past there had been the occasional date with some hopeful young man, sometimes several. But for Eunice it always felt dishonest. Every man came second best to Bomber, and no man deserved to be forever runner-up. Every relationship would only ever be friendship and sex, never love, and no friendship would ever be as precious as the one she shared with Bomber. Eventually she gave up dating altogether. She thought back to her birthday trip to Brighton all that time ago. It was almost 10 years now. It had been a wonderful day, but by the end of it her heart had been broken. On the train home, sitting next to the man she loved, Eunice had fought back the tears, knowing that she would never be the right girl for Bomber. There would never be a right girl for Bomber. But they were friends, best friends, and for Eunice that was infinitely better than not having him in her life at all. As he stirred the bolognese sauce in the kitchen, Bomber thought back to their earlier conversation. Eunice was a striking young woman with a fierce intelligence, a ready wit, and an astonishing assortment of hats. It was unfathomable that she had never been courted, or set one of her rather spectacular caps at any particular deserving young man. "Does it bother you?" He was thinking aloud, albeit a little carelessly, rather than actually posing the question. It seemed a bit blunt to ask. "Does what bother me?" Eunice appeared in the doorway, waving a breadstick in the air like a conductor's baton, and sipping a glass of red wine. "Phew, not having some handsome chap with a red sports car, a Filofax, and a flat in Chelsea." Eunice bit the end off the breadstick, decisively. "What on earth would I want with one of those, when I have you and Douglas?"
Chapter 18 "The lady doesn't want it back." Sunshine placed the cup and saucer on the table in front of Laura. "You should keep it for the lovely cup of tea." The delicate cream bone china was almost translucent, and hand-painted with deep purple violet speckled with gold. Laura looked up at Sunshine's serious face, into her treacle-dark eyes. She had brought Sunshine into the study that morning and explained in broad terms the content of Anthony's letter. "He said that you and I should take care of each other," she paraphrased. It was the first time that she had seen Sunshine smile. Curious and eager, she had handled the things in the study without seeking permission, but with a gentleness and reverence which would have delighted Anthony as much as it reassured Laura. She cradled each object in her soft hands as though it were a baby bird with a broken wing. Laura's attention returned to the cup and saucer and its cardboard label. It was certainly a strange thing to lose. "But we don't know that, Sunshine. We don't know whom it belonged to." Sunshine's conviction was immutable.
"I do. It was the lady, and she doesn't want it back to her."
Her words were delivered without a whisper of arrogance or petulance. She was simply stating a fact. "But how do you know?" Sunshine picked up the cup and held it close to her chest.
"I can feel it. I don't think it in my head. I just feel it."
She put the cup back in its saucer.
"And the lady had a bird," she added for good measure.
Laura sighed. The fate of the lost things hung over her, heavy, like a drowning man's clothes. Anthony had chosen her as his successor, and she was proud and grateful, but also terrified of failing him. And if the cup and saucer were anything to go by, Sunshine's feelings might prove to be more of a hindrance than a help.
Bone china, cup and saucer, found on a bench in the Riviera Public Gardens, 31st of October. Eulalia finally stirred in her armchair, taking in her surroundings through age-opaqued eyes. Finding them familiar, and herself quick rather than dead, a broad smile split her wrinkled brown face, revealing a haphazard assortment of still white teeth.
"Praise Jesus for one more day this side of heaven's gates," she thought. "And curse him, too!"
As arthritis shot shards of pain through her bony legs when she tried to stand up. Alive she might be, but quick she certainly wasn't. She had taken to sleeping downstairs in her chair more of late. Upstairs was fast becoming unattainable territory, which was why she was moving. Sheltered accommodation, they called it. She called it surrender. A defeated display of the lily-livered flag. But it couldn't be helped. One room with ensuite, a communal lounge, shared kitchen, and meals prepared if you wanted. Plastic mattress cover, in case you wet the bed. Eulalia shuffled through to her kitchen, sliding in her slippers and gripping her sticks like a geriatric cross-country skier. Kettle on and teabag in the mug, she opened the back door and let the sunshine in. She had once been proud of her garden. She had planned and planted it, nurtured and cherished it for all these years. But now it had outgrown her, like an unruly teenager, and ran wild. The magpie appeared at her feet as soon as the door was opened. He looked as though he was having a bad feather day, a near miss with next door's cat, perhaps. but his eyes were bright, and he chuck-chucked softly to Eulalia as he tipped his head this way and that.
"Good morning, Rossini, my friend,"
it was their little joke.
"You'll be wanting your breakfast, I suppose."
He hopped into the kitchen behind her and waited patiently for her to take a